Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from our offices overlooking San Francisco's Market Street. I am Bob Saldick, a member of the Board of Governors and your chair for today. It is my pleasure today to welcome the listeners of KARA-FM in Dallas, one of more than 225 radio stations nationwide carrying America's longest-running radio program. We invite all of our listeners here and on the radio to visit us on the Internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. Today we have the pleasure of introducing Jim Hightower, and it's my task to tell you a little bit about Jim Hightower. Jim Hightower, an author, radio commentator, public speaker, political spark plug, has spent more than two decades battling Washington and Wall Street on behalf of consumers, children, working families, environmentalists, and small businesses. He is frequently called America's most popular populist, unless, of course, you're a Washington insider or a Wall Street power broker. Then he's called something else. He's earned the enmity of the powers that be because he stands so forcefully for, as he says, the powers that ought to be, the workaday majority of Americans who live in this country. With two nationally syndicated radio shows, including his famous Hightower Radio Live from the Chat and Chew, he gets the attention of grassroots Americans, gets them involved, and gets them moving. He moved to Washington in the late 1960s. He worked for the Congressional Research Service, served as a legislative aide to U.S. Senator Ralph Yarborough. He founded a watchdog group to battle against the corporatization of farms and food. And in 1976, he returned to his home state, served as editor of the biweekly magazine, The Texas Observer. He spent a decade himself in the boiling cauldron of Texas elective politics, including winning two adventurous terms as Texas Agriculture Commissioner, 1983 to 1991. He became a national leader for family farmers, for sustainable agriculture, for farm workers, and for pure food. It's my great pleasure to introduce to you Jim Hightower.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Appreciate that. Thank you so much. Thanks especially to the Board of Governors of the Commonwealth Club for allowing a rowdy populist like myself to come into the midst of this center of enlightenment here. And thanks to Bob for that introduction. Indeed, I do not come to you as a virgin. I have been in politics in the state of Texas. I was editor, as Bob said, of the Texas Observer, then made the only downward career move you can make from journalism, and that's to go into politics. And then after that, I made the only downward career move you can make from politics, and that was to become a talk radio host in America. But it has been my joy as a talk radio host to be able to be speaking with these ordinary folks out across America, and I find that they are the ones who do the extraordinary things. They're really the strength of our country. However, I see that our politics has drifted away from those people and leaving them pretty much in the cold. And that is really why I wrote this book. If the gods had meant us to vote, they would have given us candidates. And I've got the first section of the book talks about the election that we are having. It's called Election 2000, A Space Odyssey. A Space Odyssey because, in my view, it is not really in touch with the real world in which the ordinary folks try to just make ends meet. I take on the candidates, of course, Democrat as well as Republican. I'm, of course, an old-time Democrat elected in my state. But I, right at the front of the book, do us all a public service by offering a reprise of Dan Quayle quotes. You need this, really, for your lunch appetizer. It's time for the human race to enter the solar system. I miss Dan. It isn't pollution that's harming the environment. It's the impurities in our air and water that are doing it. And, of course, one of the more famous ones. I was recently on a tour of Latin America, and the only regret I have is that I didn't study Latin harder in school so I could converse better with those people. Well, the sad news is that Dan may not be the goofiest one on this campaign trail this year. Check out our darling governor in Texas who wants to be your president, George W. Bush. What a hoot to watch him in these last few days after the wheels came off there in New Hampshire for Bush. To see him wagging his finger at John McCain and saying, you are taking corrupt corporate money into your campaign. And as Lily Tomlin once said, no matter how cynical you get, it's almost impossible to keep up. George W. Bush, or Shrub as we call him in Texas, because he's not quite as tall as a bush even. He's wagging his finger about corrupt money. He's the king of corrupt corporate cash, amassed already some $70 million into his campaign coffers, more money than's ever been raised for any presidential campaign in our history, even before the campaign began. But George says, oh, well, we have 150,000 or so contributors, and these are people who just want good government, and they're sending me their little wadded-up $20 bills. I'm humbled by their show of support. Well, I was born at night, but it wasn't last night. How about you? He didn't get $70 million from people sending in $20 bills. No, in fact, two-thirds of that money that he has amassed so far has come from 400 people, two-thirds of it, 400 people who are what he calls his pioneers. These are Washington lobbyists and corporate executives, each of whom are pledged to raise at least $100,000 for his campaign, bundling up the money through the oil and gas industry, the high-tech industry, media industry, electric utilities, chemical companies, you name it. And Bush yet even got that smirk that he can't seem to get off of his face and thumped his chest and said, hey, I'm the reform candidate. I mean, he's to reform what Colonel Sanders is to animal rights activism. Oh, geez. Well, I could go on, but I want to be getting to your questions that are more important. But I'll say that sadly, it's not just George W. Bush and John McCain, too. He's a pretty soiled savior. Lift that McCain log, and you'll see a lot of ugly squirming around under that, and both in terms of his record and, of course, in terms of the money that he's taking. But at least he's raised one progressive issue. At least he has stood up and said, yeah, the system's corrupt. I'm in it. I know the system's corrupt, and we need to stop that. And that's why I think we have a surge in a McCain candidacy. But I've got to say that it's not just the Republicans who are mired in the big muddy of big money. My party, Democratic Party, again, proud to have been elected two times state of Texas as a Democrat. But I look at my national party and I see now that they've taken off those old Sears Roebuck work boots and strapped on the same Gucci's and Poochies that the Republicans are strutting around in. I have a section in my book called Clinton's Last Erection. There are no graphics. It is not about the mess on the dress, having nothing to do with Monica. It is instead about the tower of money that Clinton has erected into his own reelection campaign and the Democratic Party generally, and now just generally in our political process, a tower of money that, of course, the Republicans exceed. But nonetheless, both parties getting mired in the money chase. Some people say we need a third party. I wish we had a second one, you know. I wish it would be my party, the Democratic Party. Here we come with the Democrats. Al Gore, a fellow whom his own mother describes as a born conformist. If you can't do better than that with your mama, I think you got a problem, you know. Well, unfortunately, he's conforming to Wall Street. Al Gore has been in his House of Representatives and senatorial career, he's done some good things, and he stood up for the environment, wrote that great book about the environment. I read it, had a lot of great stuff in it. But unfortunately, that Al Gore seems to have drifted away as he began to develop his campaign for the presidency. He had a trio of Wall Street guides, Steve Rattner, John Tisch, and Orrin Kramer, three of the Wall Street barons, who organized what they called a series of cultivational meetings for Al, cultivational meetings with Wall Street executives, for them to give him a check and then him to absorb the wisdom of how the world operates. And he began vetting his speeches through these Wall Street executives. Holy Populorum. He was vetting his speeches, literally running his speeches by them to see if it had the correct economic interpretation. We have John Corzine, who's a former CEO of Goldman Sachs. He says of Al Gore, "The vice president has tried to understand how the global economy works from the eyes of someone sitting on Wall Street." Wall Street? What about our streets? This is the Democrat. And then we have Bill Bradley, Dollar Bill Bill. "A Wall Street kind of Democrat," said one analyst, "the kind of guy corporate executives feel comfortable around, and why wouldn't they? As U.S. Senator, he was a loyal servant to corporate interests and Wall Street interests." Wall Street Journal called him the most admirable senator of this era. And indeed, who's raised the most money on Wall Street in this presidential campaign? Not Shrub Bush. Not even Al Gore, the sitting vice president. Bill Bradley has done it. This is choice. And that's what people are asking out across the country as I talk to them on the radio and talk to them in person as I do my political travels around the country. Gore and Bradley, sort of Bud Light versus Miller Light, you know. Both of them, in my view, to real Democrats, what near beer is to beer. Only maybe not quite so close. And then maybe we have Gore and Bush, Dull and Dullard, our choices, coming up in November of this year. What difference does it really make? And a lot of people ask that question. They say, what difference is it going to make to my life whether George W. Bush is sitting there or Al Gore is sitting there? And that's not an easy question to answer, and I have to tell you, I don't think Al Gore has effectively answered that, or Bill Bradley, or the Democratic Party. The real election was last year, the election of 1999. How many in this room voted? In 99 for president? No, 99 for president. This was the time when Al Gore, Bill Bradley, George Bush, John McCain went dragging a sack through the corridors of Wall Street, down here to Silicon Valley, in the Martha Stewart living rooms of the privileged, in between, collecting up those tens of millions of dollars that they now have in their campaign coffers, going to exactly the same sources. And in the process of collecting that money, they agreed to the economic agenda of the corporate and investor interests that put that money up. 1/20 of 1% of the American people voted in 1999. That's the number of people, the percentage of people, that made the campaign contributions to all four of the contenders now. 1/20 of 1%. And they, in 1999, chose our choices for us in the year 2000. That is why we have an election that is not touching the ordinary American. Why is there no discussion, for example, in this presidential election about the fact that the middle class in America is being mugged? And you say to me, well, Hightower, what are you talking about? We have unprecedented economic prosperity. The largest economic expansion in peacetime in our history, said Bill Clinton just a few weeks ago in a State of the Union address. Wall Street's whizzing. There's a boom. But most Americans are saying a boom for whom? Because they're looking around, and they know their own situation, and they're not alone. 8 out of 10 people in America have seen their incomes go flat or go down in this period of unprecedented economic prosperity. That's not poor folks, that's the middle class. 8 out of 10 of us have had no increase in prosperity. In fact, the average wage today is beneath what it was when Richard Nixon was president in terms of real buying power. This is progress. Wouldn't that make a nice debate for us to be having in America today? Wouldn't that contrast a Democrat from a Republican if they were really taking on that issue? What about the vast majority of the people? They say Wall Street's whizzing. Sure, it's whizzing on you and me if you think about it. Every time a corporate executive fires 2,000, 20,000, 40,000 workers, what happens to the stock of that corporation? Goes up. It goes up. Wall Street rewards the massive downsizings that have been taking place. Executives have their compensation attached directly to that stock price. So there's actually a financial incentive. I'm not saying that's the only reason they do this, but there's a financial incentive for executives to be downsizing, to be drop-kicking the middle class through the goalposts of global greed. Speaking of globalization, sure, we're for international trade. Got to have it. But that's not what's being pushed in the name of globalization. It's really globaloney is what it is. It's taking our good jobs at good wages, hauling them off to Southeast Shish Kebab somewhere where they can pay a nickel an hour, or pay nothing, getting slave labor, prison labor, to exploit people over there beneath a poverty wage in those countries, exploit the environment, then ship the products back here at the same high price, if not even higher, that they had been charging, with much less labor charge. Why isn't that in the political debate? Why are not the Democrats talking about globaloney or the Republicans? Number of these issues that are there that are missing because money dominates. Well, the good news, and I talk about this at length in my book. By the way, I reread it last night. This is a terrific book, I've got to tell you. I really recommend it. I tell in this book the good news, which is that the people are revolting in the good sense of that term. They are rebelling against this economic depression that is actually affecting millions of people in our country. They are rebelling against the political exclusion that is leaving them out of the process. And I tell stories in here. I'll just give you a couple of quick ones here, and then we'll get to your questions. But I'm quite an optimist in my political outlook, and I'm an optimist, as I said at the start of this peroration, because of the people themselves. Ordinary folks are doing the most extraordinary things. Granny D, do y'all know who Granny D is? She's an 89-year-old great-grandmother, began last year, January 1999, the Rose Bowl Parade in Pasadena, California, decided to walk across America to rally people's support for getting the corrupt money out of the political process. And when the Rose Bowl Parade turned off, Granny just kept going east, making 10 miles a day, 89 years of age, you know, 10 miles a day, get up in the morning, got to do it again, same the next day, through the weekend, the next week. Granny D walking 10 miles a day and inspiring people all along the way. The media hasn't focused on her, but she is a remarkable woman, and the story of her journey is remarkable because people who supposedly were told don't care anything about campaign finance reform, this is pre-John McCain by a year, were turning out in droves, bringing their children just to meet her, bringing her into the schools to give talks. She was in a biker bar in Arizona and gave a talk there in Arizona, and the biker said, "We guarantee you safe passage across America." She's touching people in a very personal way. Granny D, she turned 90 3 weeks ago in Cumberland, Maryland, her 3,000th mile. She's now in a snowbank somewhere out in the hills of Maryland, coming down to Washington, D.C. She will arrive there on February 29th, making her last walk up Pennsylvania Avenue right to the U.S. Capitol steps, where she would deliver the petition she has been assembling and deliver a hell of a speech in the process. Then she's going to serve tea to everybody who was there. Granny D, a remarkable story, a terrific woman. I tell the stories, too, about people getting involved, like young people. You hear about them. Oh, they don't care anything about money and music. They're narcissists. Well, you don't know about the United Students Against Sweatshops, if you have that feeling. This is on more than 150 campuses in this country, completely changing the sweatshop system in the world, because these students, who are never themselves going to work in a sweatshop, have on moral principle stood up against the fact that their T-shirts and sweatshirts and gimme caps and frisbees and et cetera that bear their school's logo are made by 13, 14-year-olds working in just abysmal situation with tears and blood on those products. So they have rebelled against it, and they, unlike the Congress and the administration, which have come up with a namby-pamby thing that doesn't actually get anything done, they now have Nike and Reebok on their knees because they count on those school contracts. It's a couple of billion dollars a year to be able to account for their growth. And so they have had to go along with what the students are fighting for. The students have done this, by the way, in the old-fashioned way. They have taken over the dean's offices. Many, many stories, and we can get to that in your questioning period. My basic point in this book is that the gods don't give us candidates. We have to create them. We've got to build a new politics at a grassroots level. The good news is that's happening, and I can give you some examples of that that I have in the book or others as we talk about our get into the question period here. But mainly, people want their country back. They want it back from the speculators and spoilers and the greed heads and boneheads and the big shots and bastards who have taken it from them. And they are out there organizing at a grassroots level, beneath the radar of the two-party system, beneath the radar of the media in this country, doing the kind of work that it takes, the grubhole grassroots work that it takes to have a democracy at any time in history. I think we're at another of those when in the course of human events moments in the history of the United States. I think the people are up to it, and I say, let us trust the people. I'll leave you with this thought, and then we'll get to your questions. This is an advertising slogan that a moving company in Austin, Texas, where I live, uses. Actually, they have it in the Yellow Pages. This moving company says, if we can get it loose, we can move it. And that's what's going to happen. Get it loose at the grassroots level, and the people will move this country for themselves. Thank you very much for having me at the Commonwealth Club today.
Our thanks to radio personality Jim Hightower, author of If the Gods Had Meant Us to Vote, They Would Have Given Us Candidates, for speaking to the Commonwealth Club today. Now San Francisco Chronicle columnist Phil Mateer will conduct our question and answer session.
Thank you, Bob. As you can see, this is San Francisco, so there are quite a collection of questions here, so much so that I just like, Jim, why don't you just get right up here and we can get going on this right away. A lot of you are of like mind, so I condensed some of the questions down because some of them are the second most asked questions. The first most asked question is, how can we hear more of you in this area? And for the benefit of just the locals here, how can they hear you?
Well, my radio show is not carried on an affiliate here in the San Francisco Bay Area. Our closest affiliate's down in Santa Cruz, but you can get it on the internet, jimhightower.com, real audio, so you can tune in to the Chat and Chew. And my that's a two-hour daily talk show. Then I have a daily two-minute radio commentary also available on that internet site. And I've just been visiting with some folks here who are going to work with us to see if we can't find a local affiliate for the Hightower Chat and Chew.
This is actually a lot of fun for me. This is my second interview with Jim today. I did an earlier one to be taped for a local television station this morning. And as natural in the local media or a lot of television, you don't get a lot of time. So let's dig into the issues. So, Jim, if the power is in the money, and the money is what these candidates listen to the most, and since most of us really don't have that much money, how can we, those without, make our voices and dreams be heard?
Excellent question, and of course I do get that all the time, and the way you do it is the old-fashioned way. You've got to become a citizen. Gunter Grass said the job of a citizen is to keep your mouth open. So you've got to be in the face of power, but that means also you've got to be in the voting booths. The American people have been dropping out, basically. We'll have more people who watch the Super Bowl few Sundays ago then we'll vote in the general election this fall because people feel there is no choice. But I got to say that not voting has not been a very effective message of getting across to the powers that be. I think we've got to arrive in the voting booths. There's somebody to vote for. You may not like your choices for president, but I think you'll have some choices. I think Ralph Nader is going to run on the Green Party ticket, for example, and really make a campaign of it. And if he can get into those presidential debates, which I think is quite likely this time, then it's going to be a whole different general election than it otherwise would be. So I think you'll have choices even at that level. But even if you don't like that, there are good people running for Congress, running for state rep, running for local offices, somebody running for county hide inspector out there somewhere that you need to be for. And if you don't like your Democrat-Republican choices, then there are other party choices. And if you don't like that, write in your own name. Write in Goofy, Pluto, Daffy Duck, it doesn't matter. The thing is to say, I was here. You did not scare me. I'm a citizen of the United States. You're not going to take me out of the voting booths of this country. Then the other thing you've got to do is like folks are doing around the country, and that is building at a local level a new politics that gradually rises up. We've been trying to do it just by running for president. That's not how you build a movement in America. You build it from the bottom up. And I've got a story in my book about Missoula, Montana. Folks over there fed up, not exactly a bastion of left-wing thought, by the way. Missoula, Montana, getting fed up with the Republican, Democrat, do-nothingism and siding with the developers and polluters in that town. So they heard about this thing called the New Party, and they got together, got some information, and they began to organize the old-fashioned way, door-to-door, holding potluck suppers, talking with people about what kind of community they wanted. And the bottom line on this, within 5 years, they went from nothing to now having a majority on the city council. They have two state representatives. They have a county commissioner. They have a living wage campaign underway in that town. They have become the dominant political force. They're on the move. And that's what we've got to replicate in community after community across America. And again, good news is it's happening across America.
On the national front, the Green Party, Jesse Ventura, Donald Trump, in the Reform Party, is there any chance of a third-party insurgency in American politics?
Yes, there is certainly a chance, more than a chance. It's already having success. The Greens, this new party, the Libertarians, they will run. They will contest a majority in a majority of congressional races in the country. There are all sorts of third parties that are out there organizing. I think the questioner really means, is one going to be elected president? And the answer is, we don't know. But I think that there would be third-party growth that is going to take that third-party effort, both locally, congressionally, and then presidentially, to change the two parties. And that has historically been what happened. The old-time populist movement, the 1860s, 70s, and 80s, the populist movement that was the first to call for women's suffrage, the populist movement that was first to call for wage and hour laws in America, the populist movement that was not just about the Cross of Gold speech by William Jennings Bryan, but was a genuine grassroots movement. It created its own political party. It did not elect a president, but it elected majorities in state legislatures, it elected congresspeople, it elected governors, and it completely changed the agenda of both the Republicans and the Democrats. So winning is not necessarily getting the big prize, though that is, in my view, actually possible. But nonetheless, there's a lot of ways to win in politics, and mainly it means standing on principle.
Okay, standing on principle. Which national politician on the scene today do you most admire? Also putting him on the hot seat.
Well, you know, it's too easy to be cynical about politicians because they offer us so many opportunities. But it is also true that there are people of tremendous principle. Alan Cranston sitting right down here in the front of this room being one of those. And we've got so many good folks who fight the hard fight. People like Paul Wellstone, Marcy Kaptur from Ohio, Jesse Jackson Jr. from Illinois, from Chicago. Take a look at this guy. He is already something, and he's about to be something even more. Young leaders coming up. There are good people within the political system that we need to support. We just need more of them in that process. So there are many people that I admire, but I think we've got to have a politics that is not based on a personality, a sparkly, but a politics is based on genuine grassroots organizing back down to the precinct level so that not only can we create politicians, we can take them down when they disappoint us and embarrass us.
Now for the follow-up. I can't believe we got these two questions back-to-back, but we did. You just told us the politicians you most admire. Now, in your opinion and behind the scenes, who are the most mean-spirited ones out there?
So little time. Well, there are plenty of, just utter mendacity out there. I don't want to name any names, but the initials of one is PHILGRAMM. I mean, here's a guy who just hates little people, you know, and loves taking corporate money to bash them. But, you know, there are a lot of people out there. I think Rudy Giuliani is another example in New York City that doesn't seem to like little folks very much, going after the hot dog vendors so that he can move them out so he can have a Starbucks on every corner there in New York, going after the welfare moms. Did you see in the paper the other day, by the way, that Rudy, part of his welfare to work program, it wasn't working that well because people weren't getting jobs. And so they created a business link program, it was called, and among the jobs that these welfare moms were now doing was to be telephone psychics. They were given a quickie course on how to read tarot cards. So there's progress for you.
Well, speaking of tarot cards, here in California, we have a March 7th primary that's and much of the nation is looking at, both on the Democrat and the Republican front, but especially on the Republican front. This new open primary business is something different here in California. So, in your opinion, should conscientious Democrats vote for McCain as a spoiler to prevent Bush from winning the Republican nomination? Or conversely, should McCain stand a better chance against Bradley or Gore?
Well, you've got to make that decision yourself. I'm personally not that manipulative in terms of trying to figure it all out. You usually end up stepping in your own chewing gum when you do that. You know, I would vote for McCain in this primary just simply because it is a protest vote. You are sending a message to the establishment, and certainly to Shrub Bush, who has just draped himself with the full political and financial establishment of this country and is stumbling as a result of that. So I think it is a very legitimate protest vote to be there, not for McCain so much, but against the two-party system that is not offering you a real choice. And then looking down the road to where you might have a real choice in the general election that might include, whether it's McCain, Gore, Bradley, Bush, but might include a Ralph Nader or other people in that race as well.
A lot of your talk this afternoon has been about money in politics. But one of the people in the audience just asked point blank, do you really believe politicians will ever pass a public campaign financing law? I mean, why should they even try to change the system?
No, I don't believe that they will in Washington. And we've seen the evidence of that being the very minimal step that we would take to get soft money out of the most corrupting, the most abusive, the unlimited amounts of money that corporations can give directly into the political process. We can't even pass that through the Senate. But that is not where the change is going to come. It's going to come at the grassroots level. Here's news. Massachusetts, Vermont, Maine, and Arizona, John McCain's state, all have passed public financing of their elections. And that is the only reform that is going to work in campaign finance reform. There's no loopholes possible. You take all private money out of the process. And what you get also, more importantly, is the opportunity for just regular people to run for office again, a janitor, a taxi cab driver, a teacher, a pipe fitter. You could all get claimed to the same pool of money that the incumbents have to run for office. So that's the reform that's going to matter. Four states have already passed this. Arizona, by a big majority, passed it on an initiative. And we have three more states with it on their ballot this year. 20 other states are considering. Again, the media hadn't been covering this, but it is the fastest growing reform movement in America. It's going to be the people who are going to make the change. Don't look for Washington to do it for you. They're the ones doing it to us.
Still, come the election day, you do expect us to show up. So one of the questions I saw going through a number in different voices was, aren't there real differences between the two parties, the Republican and the Democrat, on a wide variety of political issues outside the economics, from the environment to choice to tax cuts that people should be concerned with, and there's a choice there?
I think there are real differences on social issues, and those are extremely important. I think there are very little difference ultimately on environmental issues and in the real commitment to take on the environmental agenda, because that commitment requires going against the profit agenda. And by profit, I don't mean I'm against profit, but I'm talking about the greed agenda, profits beyond any relationship to the larger needs in our society, like protecting our air and our water and our food, our soil, our bodies, our babies from contamination. The Democrats have been unwilling. They have put forward some things. We've made some strides. I don't mean we've done nothing, but still fundamentally, the fight is not there. When push comes to shove that you've got to take on your campaign contributors, that's when the compromise begins, and that's too early for the compromise to begin. On, you mentioned taxes. On that issue, you've got Bradley with a tax cut and Gore and McCain and Bush, and they're arguing about it. But notice they're all talking about income taxes. The taxes that hit the American people the hardest are the payroll taxes and state sales taxes and local sales taxes and fees. We're getting eaten up. Ordinary people are paying half of their income in taxes. Yet I hear some Democrats and even some liberals say, oh, well, we're not an overtaxed nation. Well, we are. We're grossly overtaxed. If you're an average working stiff making less than $50,000 a year, by the way, that's 80% of us, make less than $50,000 a year, you're paying way too much in taxes. And we could, if we had a real Democratic candidate, be putting forward a program that says on that payroll tax, you know, the Social Security and Medicare tax, those are only go up to the first $74,000, $78,000 in income. Why do we limit it to that? Why don't we say we're going to tax the millionaires, too, with a full amount? Then you could exempt everybody who makes less than $30,000 a year. That's the working class. That's half of the people in the country. So now that would be a real debate, wouldn't it? If we said, let's go after the payroll taxes, rather than just let's finesse, you know, what big percentage, who's going to have the largest percentage going to the wealthiest people in the country of your income tax cuts? I think we need to address the payroll taxes.
Back to the horse race. Senator John McCain seems to have a message that resonates with voters. What do you think the message is, and why is it working?
I think the message is, I'm going to kick the establishment right in the ass. And that he has been relatively credible on that to this point. And that's what the good people in New Hampshire rallied to, the independents, as well as a surprising number of Republicans and some Democrats who crossed over in that primary up there. Again, here came George Bush, the heir apparent, with his chariot going right along toward the nomination. He had Greg Judd, the senator, former governor, very popular guy, dressed up like George Bush. You see it? He had the full preppy crew on there and topsiders and the whole thing campaigning in New Hampshire. He had all the money establishment, of course, up there, the lobbyists putting more money in, and then he brought in his daddy, brought in his mommy. I don't know where Millie the dog was, but I'm sure that probably around there somewhere in the snow as well. Well, he just saddled himself. It's just like writing a huge target on himself, saying, hey, I'm the establishment. I'm ready to be your president. And so people surged to John McCain because he's the anti-establishment candidate.
Now, one good whack deserves another. On the other side, Bill Bradley.
Well, he's a particular disappointment to me because I think he could have, and he said he was going to, run a real reform, real outsider kind of campaign. But in fact, it has been a sort of nitpicking, whiny, George wasn't really pro-choice. I mean, Al wasn't really pro-choice until 1980-something or other, you know, I don't know. I mean, you just want to send both of them to their rooms without supper, you know, after hearing some of this, you know, please. I mean, talk about what's really on people's minds. And again, if he's going to be the reform candidate, he should be the one talking about the payroll taxes. He should be the one talking about the globalony of globalization. He should be the one talking about the fact that the middle class is getting mugged in America and the poor people are being stiffed. He's the one should be out there really campaigning as a little D, big D Democrat, but he has not done that, and I think that he's not done it, again, primarily because he is very comfortable with that Wall Street money and doesn't want to take the kind of positions that that they would be uncomfortable with.
This one ought to be fun. Will Bill Clinton ultimately play a significant role in election 2000?
Well, already is, obviously. You know, Al Gore both distancing himself, yet on the economic prosperity that he says we're all enjoying, putting his arm around Bill, saying, I'm with him. I think also that Clinton's playing a role in terms of the money for the Democratic Party. He is out there putting another tower of money together. Now, we're in an election campaign. I can't fault the Democrats for doing that this time because we're already in it. But I fault the Democrats, including Bill Clinton, for not having done something about campaign finance reform when they really could have, like in his first term when he had a Democratic majority, and they decided to kill it rather than let that reform go through. So I think Clinton is obviously playing a role, and not to mention with his wife running in New York as well. But I think the whole agenda and the debate has been shaped by this new Democrat, nouveau Democrats agenda that Clinton has propounded and I think hung like an albatross around the neck of the Democratic Party.
One of the big issues that's going to be in this presidential contest and one that we're hearing all around the country is the state of the economy, the economic boom. So Why does the media combine to trumpet this economic boom, given the real wage stagnation that you've been talking about so much?
Well, you know, reporting used to be a job. Reporting used to be a working-class activity. You wore rumpled clothing and you pounded a beat. You went to drink after work at a place called Joe's. Then you went home to a working-class neighborhood. Well, too many of the, particularly the national byline sparklies and television anchors and et cetera, themselves and the reporters have become, well, they've moved out of that neighborhood. And they now have lunch at the Headliners Club, you know, spinning around the tallest building in town and looking down on people. And they don't go home to a working-class neighborhood. They go home to a gated compound somewhere. And not that they're mendacious, not that they that there's anything bad about them, but they, just like politicians, are no longer in touch or in tune with where regular folks are. So far, most the sort of big-name reporters, much less, of course, the assignment editors, the owners, the general managers of stations and publications, that's a whole other story. But I'm talking about even the reporters. They are now just basically aloof from the way ordinary people live. So issues like tax policy, affordable housing, affordable housing for them is let's make sure we protect the mortgage deductibility on our vacation homes. And matters like the World Trade Organization and NAFTA and the Globaloney that's being shoved down our throat in the form of these international trade scams, that's an after-dinner intellectual conversation. It's not going to affect them or their children. And so I think the media, as a result, has the same problem the politicians do. They're just in a whole different place, which is not quite Earth.
And that's what they say about San Francisco all the time. One of the things that's going to be on the horizon is Supreme Court appointments. We're going to have some coming up in the next 4 years. Now, given the choice, it's a Hobson's choice, but who would you go for realistically to try to keep the court or change the court?
That is a very, very difficult question, and that is a very legitimate confrontation that I think progressive individuals are going to have with themselves as they step into the voting booth this fall, because that is an area where there is real difference. John McCain is not a very pretty sight when you look at his record on matters of choice. George W. Bush is completely embraced and enveloped by Pat Robertson and the hard religious right and the Phyllis Schlafly's, et cetera, on that issue. And Al Gore and Bill Bradley are quite different on that issue. The question is, are you going to do it on that issue, or are you going to look at the larger need of building a true progressive politics and beginning to build a real party that focuses on not only that's good not only on those issues but also on the much broader issue that affects so many people and concerns so many people of what's happening to them economically. What about the pollution that they and their babies are consuming? Who's going to dare challenge the genetically manipulated organisms that are going into our food without us even being consulted or told about it? That's a bigger fight, it seems to me, and that's a choice that I'm going to make in the polls by if it is Gore or Gore Bush, then I'm going to go with Ralph Nader because I think we've got to build something for the long haul. But at the same time, I'm certainly not going to be mad at the people, the progressives, who say, look, I got to just take care of what we got here, and I've got to fight a defensive battle. Ultimately, though, I think this year's election is less important at a presidential level than it is people running for state legislature and the local base out there. That is that grassroots new party building that we've got to do to change politics so that 4 years, 8 years, 12 years from now, we're not standing around scratching our butts saying, "Oh God, I don't know. You know, what should I do? Which is the least of evils here?"
National health care. Will it work? Should we have it?
Of course, it'll work. It works around the world. It works in the Congress of the United States. But again, where are the Democrats? We've got Al and Bill having this little nattering discussion about, you know, whose health care bill does what. It's like two insurance salesmen in your living room at the same time, you know, trying to explain their term life annuities to you, you know. I mean, why aren't the Democrats saying single-payer system? Let's get the insurance bureaucracy out of this system. Put our money into the doctors.
This is one I hear all the time. It's a catch-22, so I want you to dive in the middle of it. Doesn't a politician have to be elected before he or she can do any good? And then doesn't he or she have to say the right things to get elected?
Well, I mean, we've been doing that. We've been through now two terms of the Clinton administration saying the things that are necessary to get elected and doing the things that are necessary to get elected, yet not doing good once they're in office. Clinton, in my view, is the best Republican president we've had since Eisenhower. He's been good on social issues, bad on economic issues. And that's the reverse of where most people are in this country. I'm not saying we should be bad on social issues, but at least let's be good on the economic issues and reach out to people on that basis. Start with where we've got agreement with the American people, and that is the vast majority, again, that 8 out of 10 who make less than $50,000 a year, the 8 out of 10 who have seen their incomes go flat or go down, the 7 out of 10 who won't get a four-year college degree, the 7 out of 10 who are not voting, at least in congressional elections in the country. Let's fish in the deep pool for a change.
Who is the most powerful and who scares you the most? Tom DeLay, Dick Armey, or Bill Archer?
Yes. The three-headed force of evil in the Republican Congress. Tom DeLay is really the most awful, I think, in... Even, maybe even in the whole Congress. I mean, that is a challenge because you've got the Bob Barrs and the Bill McCallums and et cetera. But DeLay has real power, and he uses that power. You know, he's known as the hammer in the Congress because he's the one that literally carries a book or has a book with him that if a lobbyist comes to a member and says, I want you to carry this for me, that member is instructed to say, check with Tom. You've got to check with Tom. And Tom looks over the book and says, my, you seem to have been giving money to the Democrats, and you're not giving enough to us as Republicans. You need to improve your record, and then you come see me. That literally took place during the Newt Gingrich years with Tom DeLay. I have a chapter in my book about Tom DeLay, our man from Saipan. I don't know if you know about the Saipan situation, this island where so many thousands of American soldiers died over there in a World War II battle, not to mention many more thousands of Japanese soldiers. But Saipan is now a sweatshop haven. And it exists as a sweatshop haven because it's a commonwealth of the United States but has not been made, as Puerto Rico and other commonwealths do, to comply with our labor laws and our immigration laws. So they bring impoverished young women and girls from Bangladesh and China into onto this island of Saipan, telling them they're going to America because it is a U.S. commonwealth. And then when they arrive, they take their passports away from them. They force them to live in barracks with razor wire on them. They work 16 hours a day. It is an absolutely abhorrent sweatshop that Nordstrom's and Gap and Talbot's and Walmart and Sears and JCPenney and et cetera, get their clothes made there. And not only do they get them made there at that incredibly subsidized rate through the sweatshops, but then they can ship them back to America with no tariff, no quota, and with a Made in the USA label on them, because they're made in the Commonwealth of Saipan. Tom DeLay is the one who not only has protected that system, protected Saipan, taking money from the sweatshop operators, but also has said, we need to bring that system to the United States. Why can't U.S. manufacturers go into Mexico and elsewhere in Latin America and bring these indentured servants in here? That's Tom DeLay, so I think he's our prize winner.
Tough field, but I'm glad you picked one. Conventional wisdom, I love that word, those two words together, says that the economy is good and therefore the incumbents will be reelected. You've talked a lot about national politics, but you've also talked a lot about more on the state and local level. Do you think that incumbents are just going to be returned this time?
Yes, basically, yes, I do. And there's a reason for that. The main reason is generally people are not hearing the kind of good message that they need to hear to be motivated to go vote and participate. So, again, I think we're going to have a very low turnout. That augurs for incumbency. And then we have a stacked system. Not only the money that incumbents are able to get, they have an overwhelming advantage over any challenger, but also the fact that we basically rigged the congressional districts, for example, so that they're overwhelmingly safe districts. There'll be only less than 10% of the districts will be seriously contested in this congressional election. You are four times more likely to die in office in Congress than you are to be defeated in Congress. Just a statistic for you today.
Okay. How could economics have a healthy relationship to politics?
Well, if politics had a healthy relationship with the real economy, with the people who are being knocked down, and there was actually a contest between those who are prospering and those who are I don't mean just those who are prospering. That's too broad of a group. I really mean those who are the decision makers, the corporate executives, the investment bankers, who are really the ones who are making these decisions, not in collusion, but in a sort of collusion of world outlook, and then buying the politicians in the process to be the puppets that sustain their system that removes them from the rest of us. So there's got that group, and then if you had a politics that was appealing to everybody else who is left out of that, then you would have a real healthy politics going on. I happen to think that corporate executives deserve representation. They ought to have one party, and the Republican Party has done fine for them throughout history, so let them have that party. But let us have our party back, and I think the kind of politics that matters, that the core of that politics has got to get back to something we've abandoned, and that is the common good in our country. That's who we are. We're the United States of America, right? But the common good has been displaced by this ethic of greed that says, I got mine, you get yours. Never give a sucker an even chance. I'm rich and you're not. Adios, chump. And they live in gated compounds, and they take the taxpayers' dollars to build stadiums, and then they have luxury skyboxes so they don't have to breathe the air with a riffraff who's down there having footed the bill for their stadium. They send their kids to private schools. They don't use public parks. They have no need for them, so they're wanting to defund the public parks. They want to defund the public schools. They're separating themselves from the many. That's a very dangerous thing for them to be doing. It's a wrong thing, and it is not only bad for the people who are being shut out, but it's bad for everybody, because if we're not a United States of America, then we are not a united people, and it means that we've got a heap of trouble coming down the road, because the middle class, it's not like holding down poor people. We're pretty good at that in America. We've been doing that for years, but holding down the middle class, that's something much tougher. Who do you think's in the militia? It's not just gun nuts and xenophobes and racists. Sure, they're in there. But the bulk of the members in there are those family farmers who lost their farms in the 1980s, some in the 1990s, still going on, through no fault of their own. It's the former United Auto workers who've had their jobs at General Motors shipped 73,000 jobs out of this country, shut down 73,000 jobs here, created 73,000 in Brazil, Mexico, and China. You're not going to shut those people out. They're going to find a channel. And I think that's why it's so important and why I write this book, for us to create a progressive, genuinely progressive political alternative for those people. Because if we don't, we're going to be a disunited States of America.
Here in California, we have term limits. A lot of people have questions about that. Term limits, how do you stand on them?
I differ with most of my progressive friends here, because I favor term limits, but not by themselves. Term limits with the full range of campaign finance reform, public financing, free airtime. You ought to have to raise the majority of your money from a zip code somewhere near the district that you're actually going to try to represent. You know, I mean, a full panoply of reforms, but I think term limits is not inherently a bad idea because it goes back to the original concept that we ought to be a government of the citizenry. And you can't tell me there's not at least 435 others who can do as good a job as the 435 who are in there now. Susan DeMarco, who's the co-host of my radio show with me, we have a DeMarcoocracy program. She believes instead of electing members of Congress, we should just draw randomly from the populace. Anybody who wants to be in Congress gets to put their name in the basket, and we draw the name out, and you're in. You get that $140,000 a year and health care.
I have to give a hand on that one. Like I said, there is an election going on, so we can't let anybody leave without one last question and demand a gaze into the crystal ball. So come on up. When this campaign is all said and done, will George W. Bush beat Dan Quayle's record for the most verbal missteps?
That's Olympic quality stuff, but I think George might have it in him. Thank you.
Our thanks to Jim Hightower, nationally syndicated radio host and author of If the Gods Had Meant Us to Vote, They Would Have Given Us Candidates. Thanks for coming to here today. We also like to thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club, as well as those listening on radio. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and Stacy's Bookstore is adjourned.